human eyes that I may see glimpses of truth asked for me. Open mine eyes, illumine me, Spirit Divine.
Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I present people who are really at the leading edge of a new technology, a new science that's coming to the planet. It really is a science spiritual revolution that we're in, and we're coming to reevaluate a lot of the old ideas about who we are and what's possible into a new world and to a new realities. That's why I call the show New Realities. Tonight's guest is Claude Swanson, and he's written a book called The Synchronized Universe, where he talks about the new science of, I would say, spirituality. Would you say that, Claude?
Yes, that's quite accurate.
And for a long time, it's been given a bad name, like paranormal or occult, but these, I feel all those things are really just our basic human abilities. That's sort of where you go with it, right?
It really is. I call my book The Synchronized Universe, and it's the subtitle is New Science of the Paranormal, which it does have those negative connotations in some ways, but I think it's time for our science to really realize that these are part of normal. It's part of the real universe, and hopefully our science can start to grow up and expand and begin to realize these other aspects of us are not so unusual after all. They really kind of fit into a larger picture of who we are.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you really highlight in your book, you know, all the major, extraordinary events that have happened, that people have died, out-of-body experiences, remote viewing, extrasensory perception. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of people in the remote viewing field. I've interviewed Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff, and I've done the experiments myself, and I have remote viewed. I've gotten the targets. I mean, all these things that you, I mean, in a way you've written as if it's highlighted almost around some special people, but how do you start to tell people that we all have this ability, you know?
Well, I start with my story in the introduction of my book. I was a classically trained quantum physicist. I went to MIT undergraduate and Princeton for graduate school, a PhD in physics there. And I was, you know, trying to understand how the universe worked. And it was my curiosity that pulled me into this, and I kept feeling that something was missing. This whole picture seemed kind of superficial, and then in the mid-80s, I began to hear rumors about remote viewing, and I heard it in such a way that I realized it had to be true, and yet it goes against the basic paradigm of modern science. So I began digging into it really very thoroughly to figure out, well, what's true and how does it work? And eventually, 10 years later, I took some classes, just like you did, in remote viewing. And when you have the direct experience, it pretty much removes any doubt that that these things are possible. What it tells us about our universe is that there are higher dimensions. There's more to it than our Western materialistic science has really, you know, tried to account for so far. It's a much bigger world with these higher dimensions and other qualities, and the power of consciousness, which really kind of surpasses the physical forces that are part of the mainstream physics. So I've really been trying to understand what the facts are in all these different areas to figure out, well, what's the data, well, what's the proof, what's real, and then second, well, how do we explain this? How can we fix our science up to catch up with what we're seeing?
Well, that's exactly what this program is dedicated to. It's dedicated to understanding new paradigms of the world, and obviously, like when you say, these things that we both have experience with are true, and they do not fit into the existing paradigm, Well, it doesn't mean the experiences aren't true. It means the paradigm is obviously has some holes in it. So what people, I think, are so important in doing is building a new paradigm, which means we have to redefine about what's possible to really create new ideas. I mean, the idea that I've heard a lot is that consciousness is non-local, right? Uh-huh. That's sort of the bridge into a new paradigm. And there's a science of consciousness that we have yet to understand. So give us some of your theories and redefining of the new paradigm as you see it.
Sure. Well, in my book, I really spend the first 12 chapters trying to pull together the best evidence for a variety of different phenomena, because the biggest problem with scientists and maybe the average person on the street is most people don't know about this stuff, you know, or they know a little bit, but they've heard rumors and, you know, they don't know what to believe. So I really pull up the scientific experiments and describe them fairly carefully to say, what's the proof for the near-death experience, for example, or the out-of-body experience, or remote viewing, or ESP, you know, and there are laboratories that have done thousands, even hundreds of thousands of experiments, like the Princeton Pear Lab, you know.
Exactly, with the you know, four hours before the World Trade Center was hit, they already showed signs of patterns being registered in this random kind of electronic coin toss.
Exactly, these random event generators that are like little coin tossers, and they had 50 or 60 of them all around the world, and they were all showing anomalies, which meant something, that the consciousness of the humans on the planet was actually changing the physics.
But even so before it happened, even in a precognitive way, which was so shocking about that particular example.
Exactly.
You know?
Right.
But besides, okay, there's actually probably thousands or 10,000 examples of things that don't fit into the old paradigm. So what, if you can define what the new paradigm looks like according to all the research you've done, how would you state it?
I need three or four sentences here.
Sure.
But I have a model that I describe in the last chapter of my book that I call the synchronized universe model, or the SUM, S-U-M, SUM mm-hmm. model. And it's really based on a principle called Mach's principle. Ernst Mach, who invented the Mach number for high-speed flight, mm-hmm. also had this idea that we are all connected, that the distant matter of the universe is connected to everything that's happening locally here, you know, on Earth, and that there's an interaction all the time. Then in the 40s, Feynman and Wheeler, these two famous physicists, extended that idea, took it a little further, and showed that if you allow interaction of that type, then everything becomes coupled together. So this is sort of the starting point of my model, that there's a coupling between things that are far away and things that are nearby. And if you take one more step beyond that, there's a synchronizing effect, so that the motions of things nearby and far away become synchronized with each other, and that leads to multiple parallel universes.
Wait, so go into a little more specifics about the relationships between near and far objects. How does that actually work?
Okay. The idea of Ernst Mach was that that things that are far away, that really means all of the matter in the universe.
Everything is far away. It depends. It could be next door or down the street or around on the other side of the galaxy, you mean.
Right. And in the 40s, Richard Feynman and John Wheeler, who Richard Feynman was a Nobel Prize winner and a very famous physicist.
Right.
And his teacher was John Wheeler. And what they realized is that that whenever a particle sends out light, sends out a photon, sends out radiation, and really at the very small scale, they're doing that all the time. And if you follow that little particle of light, it most likely will get absorbed when it's traveled about halfway across the universe and gets absorbed by the distant matter way out there, 10 billion light years away. So you're really coupling things that are very far apart. And the only way that can make any sense to a physicist is if you also allow the signals to go backwards in time as well as forwards in time. So things that happen way out there can also come back and affect us here. So there's a coupling.
But let me just understand the thing about a photon is emitted somewhere and then it's absorbed somewhere. So there's a relationship between the place that emits the photon and the place that absorbs the photon. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. That's right.
And then,
so that if,
yeah. Go ahead. No.
So that if you, any little particle, and I don't know if we're going in too much detail for your listeners.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Yeah. So every little particle, like an electron would be sort of the simplest example of a massive particle in physics. Even though in our present physics we say it's just sitting still, but at a more detailed level there's a very rapid motion that's going on. The electron is zipping back and forth at the speed of light within a small volume and interacting with the energy of the vacuum. So there's this very rapid dance that goes on if you could look at it with a very powerful microscope. The view of some physicists is that every time the electron makes a motion, changes direction, zigs or zags, it's sending out a photon or hitting a photon from somewhere else. So there's a coupling there. So even though it looks like it's sitting still, on a very detailed level, there's a lot of activity as it interacts with other particles that are far away. And this is sort of a picture of the David Bohm, and in more recent times, you mentioned Hal Puthoff, mm-hmm. and other physicists have also tried to develop this idea that there is, at a more detailed level, that our quantum picture we have today is not the final answer, and there's something that happens at a more detailed level, a mechanism that explains why things act the way they do, and this is where the energy of the vacuum, the zero-point energy, comes in.
Right. So let me just understand what you've said so far. On this micro level, this electron is moving or vibrating, interacting with photons that are affecting the reality around it, let's say.
Right.
Is that right?
That's fair, yeah.
Okay.
And what happens is in this picture, because of the way the electron interacts with light, with photons, at very high speeds, and it's actually traveling at very high speeds at the microscopic scale, it tends to only see other particles which are right in front of it, that is directly ahead of it. This is a relativistic effect from Einstein, so that there's it's like each electron has tunnel vision. It only can see straight ahead. So that leads to a conclusion that even though you're interacting with electrons that are very far away, they only interact when they happen to be lined up, when their velocities line up just right. Mm-hmm. That allows them to couple even over the large distances. This leads to the conclusion that their motions will become synchronized, so that there's a small orbiting effect which becomes synchronized over large distances. So that's really
how do electrons that are far apart synchronize together if they're so far apart and they only kind of interact with what's right in front of them? How does that happen? Does that happen between different atoms as well? Or can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, the key part of that is that just like the Feynman-Wheeler model, I allow the photons to travel backwards in time as well as forward in time. So a photon may spend 10 billion light years traveling out and interact with some particle, at the far reaches of the universe, but when it does, it'll cause that particle to wiggle. It'll accelerate it in some way, and that'll cause it to emit a photon when that happens. If that photon travels backwards in time, it'll come back, and then 10 billion years earlier, will interact with the local one. Well, and even though this may sound like a really strange idea, for physicists, particles traveling backwards in time is not that unusual. In fact, it's really part of the current theory. Antiparticles are examples of particles traveling backwards in time.
Oh.
So,
Oh, I didn't know an antiparticle. I thought it was just kind of a negative energy or the opposite of energy. I didn't realize it had a time component to it as well.
Yeah, that was one of Richard Feynman's great contributions to physics, that he realized that when you assume that an antiparticle is a particle traveling backwards in time, all the equations become very simple. And so when you draw diagrams now, you assume that that's what's going on.
I see. So, okay, so you have this idea about electrons, and how does this then affect human consciousness and things we call paranormal?
The challenge with paranormal things is that our minds can couple to other minds or to other objects very far away. This is the
in
part
time and space, far away in time and far away in space.
Exactly. And this is true across the entire range of paranormal phenomena. It's true in remote viewing. You can be given a target that happened, you know, 65 million years ago, or 10,000 years in the future, or 10,000 miles away, or Alpha Centauri. The remote viewing targets, you know, it does not affect the difficulty of the remote viewing session. And according to people who've done these comparisons, like the Princeton Pear Lab, the accuracy does not go down with distance and does not decrease with time offset. So remote viewing is just one of these examples of something where the time and the space don't really weaken the coupling.
Well, it's true, because I talked to Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ about the experiments they did where the remote viewer drew a place that someone would be even before they knew they would be there, and they got the target of someone who's going to show up somewhere in 2 hours before. And does that then mean that there's no free will in a way, that everything is predetermined? I mean, how do you reason that?
Well, you've gone right to the heart of the problem.
Oh, yeah.
I do address that in my book. It is one of the challenges of all kinds of information like this.
Yeah.
I mean, for as just one more example, just to,
yeah,
before I talk about that, is the near-death experience,
mm-hmm,
where again people go to this other dimension. At least that's what they say. They describe, mm-hmm, their experiences there, and no matter what their background, they tend to describe very similar experiences. They often come back with information of this same type, information that would defy space and time. There are a couple examples in my book. One fellow named Harry Hone, who had a near-death experience and came back, and he'd been told while he was dead where his long-missing sister was. Over 35 years, he was given an address halfway around the world in Australia, and he found her there. Daniel Brinkley, who's a pretty famous experiencer, was dead for 28 minutes the first time.
Right.
When he came back, they'd given him 117 visions of the future. This was 1975. Dr. Raymond Moody wrote them all down. About 98% of them have come true now. So it's like in these other dimensions, time and space don't matter the way we think they do. That is the challenge, and I think this idea of the connectedness of distant matter to things that are very close is really the key to having a higher dimensional picture.
It's not just the distance. Sorry, so just inspired that idea behind Bell's theorem in a sense where there is really no distance at all. The distance is the illusion, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
the answer, I guess, that I suggest is that I draw a picture of a ball rolling down a hill, and the hill has ripples or arroyos, little ridges and grooves in it from erosion, and so the ball can get caught in one of those little arroyos and get down the hill along some particular path,
mm-hmm,
and that's a very likely path, unless it hits some branch point where it might go from one to the other. And any given path, you know, the ball will have a probability of ending up at a certain place. But I think our consciousness seems to have the ability to change that terrain. So we seem to have an ability to alter that terrain, but probably we can have the best chance of altering it at these crossing points, at these switch points where there's a branch, where there are two almost equal paths, and then we can shift the ball from one to the other. So I suspect that free will comes in most often when we're shifting between two paths that don't require a lot of energy to go from one to the other. Because if you look at, if you talk to remote viewers, and if you talk to medicine men in the Native American tradition, various types of people who deal in these realms, what they often say is that there's more than one possible future, but it's not an infinite number. It's a limited number.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that. So you're saying the ball will eventually end up downhill no matter what you do, in a way, right?
It'll end up downhill, but the path that it ends up on, you can change it, but within limits.
You don't believe in the many worlds theory where you can change your timeline and create a whole different future. I mean, there's like some kind of theory where every moment the world is bifurcating, every second, every little decision's creating a different possible universe, and there's all these infinite universes that are splintering off from this moment, like I could have said that instead of this, and it's like, and so there's some theory about that, but it doesn't sound like you support that.
The problem I have with that, with the many worlds idea, is it has so many possible futures that it would be completely impossible to make any kind of prediction about the future. In other words, that we start looking at the history of prophecy of people who do make predictions. I mean, for example, Joe McMonigle, who's a famous remote viewer. He was in the military remote viewing program, his number was 001, you know, and he had an accuracy rate between 65% and 80% for future targets.
Right.
And, you know, there's one anecdote he talks about, which is true, where a TV station was doing a test of him, and they told him they were going to give him six different, pick one of six different targets, basically, and at the last minute, and they would, and then kind of see how he did on his test, and they would have cameras at each of the spots, at each of the locations, and then at the moment they would say, okay, it's target A, tell us what's happening there. And what he actually described in real time was a ship pulling up to a dock, which was correct for what was happening at that target. But later he told the producer that he'd already, like, you know, days before, figured out all the six targets they were going to give him and which one they were going to, you know, going to select among them. So he was able to look into the future pretty accurately.
And
the many worlds theory couldn't explain something like that.
So your theory then is, let's say, so there is a relationship between, like, all time and all space, and there's a sort of flow to from the past to the present, and then from the present back to the past or the future. And so what's the paradigm that involves then consciousness, time, space? How would you, like, if you were living 200 years in the future, and you know, we have this materialistic paradigm about, you know, basically Newton's clockwork universe. I mean, we're moving out of that with quantum physics, but it hasn't quite caught hold of the popular culture. But we're moving into something new, and I think quantum physics is sort of a in-between step between what we sort of know and what we don't know.
I agree with you.
Yeah, so we're coming into something brand new. If you could then be like a paradigm predictor of the future or living in the future, how would you explain what all the contradictions and all the paradoxes that we now see with a new unified theory? What would that be?
Okay,
first of all, synchronized universe, is it? Yeah.
Not asking much, but anyway.
Okay.
I I'm sort of giving you this picture level by level, okay, just to make it clear.
Good.
And so at this first level, consciousness and freedom of choice come in by affecting the future at these crux points where things are, probabilities are almost matched and our free will has the best chance, or our consciousness, you know, our ability to project it has the best chance of affecting something. And that's kind of, that's not that far from the universe that we're normally living in. In our everyday physics, we have this idea that the quantum mechanical model works, and we're moving into something where consciousness and the energies of consciousness are lifting us into a higher dimensional view of how things happen. And so the first step in that picture is the ability of consciousness to shift the terrain at these crux points to change probabilities of certain events. Now, there is a higher dimensional view than that, that I mentioned, the synchronized universe idea, that because of how particles synchronize with each other in this model, you end up with, very naturally, a bunch of parallel levels, parallel realities. We would call them four-dimensional, I mean, space-time, four-dimensional, physical realities, we would say, and we're in one of them. You can think about it like a sheet of paper, and that you know, describes our reality if we're on that sheet of paper, and our conventional physics describes the events when we're on that sheet of paper.
Mm-hmm.
But in this big stack of paper, you have other sheets that have other universes, and you could be on one of the other universes, and you see things different that are happening, but you would still see the laws of conventional physics describing things as long as they're on that sheet of paper. What happens with consciousness is that it begins to shift you from one sheet of paper to another, or to couple events that are happening across these sheets of paper. There's a concept called subtle energy, or chi, or prana, the
life force.
The life force, exactly. And that energy is something that's not accounted for in current physics, but that's what shifts you from one of these realities to another. And when you begin, well, like an adept or a yogi, building up your subtle energy, then you can start to manipulate, and you can start to work among, you know, have your consciousness in several of these planes at the same time and cause things to happen that are just, you know, totally defy Western physics. So that is the next paradigm that we're shifting into as people develop more abilities to interact at a higher level.
Well, let me just talk about that, because, you know, the problem with Western physics, Newtonian physics, is this idea of entropy, and the universe is a closed system, and eventually it's running down. But when you talk about chi or life force, it's obvious that there's life force in the universe, and it's building towards complexity, what they call negative entropy, right? So, I mean, we need to come up with a paradigm, a way of thinking about the world, that where the life force, consciousness, negative entropy, which is an awful word, is is prominent, right?
Right, exactly. And, and actually, there are some places in the world where a scientific analysis of the life force has gone pretty far, and in the West we don't seem to have been given the news yet. But a Russian scientist back in the 50s named Nikolai Kozarev, who was looking at stars and orbiting binary star systems, but came up with the idea that the entropy that was increasing from the burning process in the star was causing something else, was causing what he called a change in the time density, and basically ends up being negative entropy, that was affecting the system. And what happened is a whole long series of events that happened after that. Other scientists who checked his work and have extended it, theories have been developed in Russia primarily, so that this negative entropy, or the life force, the building force, you know, has been received a lot of attention and a lot of scientific work, you know, in certain small circles.
Wait,
and,
so I just want to understand that concept of that Russian scientist. You're saying as the star was increasing in entropy, It was also building in coherence and negative entropy, which we equate to life. It was doing two things at once.
The entropy increasing in one area was actually coupled to a decrease of entropy elsewhere. It changed. I mean, it's a little, his original ideas, it's probably hard to retrace it historically, in a short time and make too much sense out of it. It'd be easier if I just said it this way, that, we can think about, go back to my picture of a little particle bouncing around in space-time while the photons are hitting it, okay, and knocking it around. In that picture, that electron, sort of wanders forward in time, okay? It goes backwards in time and forwards in time, but on the average, it keeps moving forwards in time. So we say, you know, time is passing. It's going into the future, like, you know, all the things that we expect ought to go. But the things that are hitting it in the Russian model are not really photons. They're particles that have a spin. And a certain spin, which is the predominant spin, causes them to kind of move on the average forward in time. But what the Russians say is there's another particle which has the opposite spin, and that knocks the electron backwards in time. And so its progress is always this interaction, this dialogue between these two different fluxes, one forward and one backward in time. And the one that pushes forward in time is in predominance, but both of them are present. And what they say is that you can, in certain physical processes or biological processes, you can make more of the other particle, of the backward in time particle, and therefore cause events to change their behavior. You can make clocks slow down. You can cause a variety of really strange effects so that it becomes a force that you can make a science out of.
Well, how do you cause that? How is that cause generated? Slowing down clocks, or is it something that consciousness, it seems like, you talk about Uri Geller, he seems to be tapped into something else where he can do those sort of things. So is it something consciousness seems like it's geared to doing, which is playing with time in a sense?
Yeah, I mean, this is what yogis and adepts learn to do when you do your pranayama, your yogic breathing, okay? What they're doing is they're taking in air, and it just turns out that sunlight has both of these polarities of spin, both time direction type spins, mm-hmm. present in sunlight. But oxygen just happens to like to collect more of the negative spin or the backward in time component. So when you breathe air, you're actually taking in some of this special energy. And normally you breathe it in, you breathe it out, and there's no net gain, you don't notice anything. But the amazing thing about this energy is it responds to consciousness. And this is what makes it...
Which energy exactly responds to consciousness? And that example of oxygen, I mean, enough oxygen will start to slow time as well?
I know I'm saying a lot of things at the same time.
No, I'm trying to absorb it, and I think it's great, and it's really interesting, and it's great. I'm really happy with all the research, and this is exactly what I want to learn as far as how we're going to create a new paradigm that includes all these ideas. So I think you're really building great groundwork for it, so it's okay.
One of the names that the Russians use for this type of energy, besides life force, is torsion. Okay, torsion.
Oh, do you know the work of Nassim Haram?
I don't.
He's all about developing theories with torsion fields. He says this explains everything. The spin,
it
explains all the dark matter, all the, you know, empty space. He's a real brilliant guy because he says actually in the center of everything is a black hole. Mm. And that's what creates that spin. It's more detailed than that. But go ahead.
Yeah. When I talk about, you know, these little particles that are knocking the electron forward or backward in time, I'm really speaking of particles of torsion, okay? They would call it the quanta of torsion. And there's two spins, and one pushes it forward in time, and one backwards in time. And what can happen is that matter does not have to always be in balance between these two. Certain types of matter tend to collect more of one spin or the other. and therefore we'd say that it is a psychically charged or energetically charged object. And it's, we say that charge not as electrically charged, but in terms of subtle energy or torsion. So there's a tremendous amount of work that's been done on this. It's just not very well known in the West, and I'm working on a second book in which I bring all this stuff together.
Consciousness affect the spin, that torsion, or would spin affect consciousness, or is it both?
Both.
I mean,
the unusual thing about this energy is that it couples to consciousness. Unlike electromagnetism and the other forces, this energy seems to couple to consciousness, and you might even think about consciousness as being made up of this energy, but that's, you know, down the road. But the point is, when a yogi sits and does his deep breathing, he focuses on collecting energy within his body, and he builds it up. So you get a large concentration of this negative entropic energy in your body. And
but
that's
if you
what
say... Right, I'm following. But if you say it couples to consciousness and that spin is throughout the whole universe, then you're saying, in a sense, that the universe is a conscious being. I think I'm kind of pushing it a couple of steps.
Yeah,
but is that what you're saying?
I think we're getting there. I think we're getting to the point where we would probably say that. Yeah, I mean, I think any object that has some of this energy in it has an element of consciousness in it.
So in the new paradigms, in the new science that you are unfolding step by step, you're saying in a sense that consciousness, like Amit Goswami said in the Conscious Universe, is the ground of all being. Right? Would you say that in a sense with these principles?
I probably would. I mean, I know this is something that adepts have said for a long time. I'm kind of working my way step by step. To get there, sort of building a little sort of a scientific road to try to, you know, to make that something that I could defend as a scientific model. So that, because to do that, then means that scientists can also follow along, you know, that type of conclusion. But I think, for example, when you say that, what I think of is this idea of the parallel universes, the parallel sheets of paper that. Consciousness enables us, for example, to focus on one sheet or another sheet. That the way that great healers in many different traditions, I'm not sure how much you've studied this, but you know, some of these guys can cause instantaneous healing. They can cause changes that completely defy Western physics. You know,
do they do that? Are you saying how is it possible?
This is sort of a typical shamanic type healing.
I know it's possible, but how are you saying they do it? Through what mechanism?
Because you come to a person and you have a broken bone, let's say. Okay, mm-hmm. Come to a shaman, you have a broken bone. And in our conventional paradigm, in the best of all possible worlds, he gives you some healing energy and it speeds up the healing. And in, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, maybe the bone mends back. But in the shamanic paradigm, he does his ceremony, and this bone is healed, and it has no record of ever having been broken. You know, and there are scientific, you know, cases where this has happened. And the only way I can see to explain that is that he shifted both you and himself from one sheet of paper, one parallel reality, to another one.
So in a way, then that ball doesn't end up at the bottom of the hill. I mean, in the sense
shaman is around. He can do pretty much anything with that ball, right?
But we all have that potential in us, you know. That's what consciousness is, to shift those pieces of paper, in a sense. I mean, we have that ability. We're all adepts, potential adepts and yogis. And I think, right?
I agree.
So how do we then activate the consciousness awareness to know that we're that? I mean, of course, maybe it takes years of practice, or maybe you have a formula that you can.
I took a very interesting course with a man named Richard Bartlett of Matrix Energetics a couple of months ago. I don't know if you know his work at all or not.
I do. I've seen him work. I haven't really studied it, but yeah. What do you make of that work?
Well, it looks like it's real, and it seems as though he has a formula for teaching people how to do this. And in my little metaphor of the sheets of paper for the parallel realities, you know, we all kind of go along in our normal life focused on what we think of as reality. And it may be our consciousness that keeps us hooked into that level of reality. And if we could shift, if we were able, like a shaman, to shift to another level of reality, then we might not be stuck where we are. We might suddenly find things are different. What Bartlett teaches is you enter a state where you kind of defocus, where you defocus any kind of thought about any reality, and you also give up any thought about what you want to achieve, about what the ends are, you know. So there may be an initial part of your session where you're talking about what you want, but then when you release, you actually kind of defocus. It's as though your consciousness is spread over all these different layers of reality. And then when you come out of that, you find yourself in perhaps a different plane, a different parallel reality, which is the one you wanted. So as best I can explain right now, that's what a shaman does, and that's what Bartlett's doing. So it fits in with my model, so I like that part of it.
It does. And another person who explains this is Castaneda, where he talks about the assemblage point. Have you read those books where the assemblage point is a point of consciousness on the energetic field of a person?
I've only read a little bit of Castaneda. I've not read that book.
Oh, read the later books, A Fire from Within. He gives a really interesting model for shifting realities. Very brilliant. But getting back to your model and consciousness, I mean, I followed you so far, but it's like when you throw consciousness into it, I don't lose you, but I think scientists lose you, because I don't think Feynman, and maybe Wheeler, but I don't think Feynman was aware of the consciousness part of that spin equation, right? So how do you get there?
Yeah, they were complete skeptics, right?
Right.
So especially Feynman.
Right.
That's why I try to take a kind of an empirical view and talk about the experiments and try to lead people along step by step, because after all, science is supposed to explain experiments. And it's not fair for scientists to just, you know, ignore overlook experiments. And yet that's how mainstream science has been functioning. You know, we have a lot of anomalies right now in mainstream science, and pretty much they're just being overlooked rather than being dealt with.
Well, that's the problem when, you know, that's why you're building a new science. And this is, you know, Edgar Mitchell, noetic science, the science of life.
My model for consciousness right now, and I'll oversimplify, but it's, if you just think about the head, okay, and we know that our consciousness extends well beyond the head, but just think of it as some mass of electrical currents and particles that are interacting with each other pretty strongly, so that you can create certain vibrations and certain patterns of energy in that volume that you have some kind of control over, okay? And what happens in this synchronized universe model is that the currents and the energy patterns in the mind will interact with the distant matter of the universe. They'll actually set up vibrations that are between one and the other, so that you're actually changing the context for the rest of the universe. You can cause a coupling to occur between the mind and the distant matter, which can then refocus at some other location. And I'll talk about that if you want me to. But
Please. That means sort of the butterfly effect, right? What you do.
Because of the way this model is put together, where energy can travel forwards and backwards in time, when my mind takes on a certain pattern and sends out energy, it sends it out into the future and into the past. And so it will reflect off of the rest of the matter in the universe, both in the past and in the future. And therefore, you have two sets of waves, one from the future, one from the past, both coming back into the present, and they will converge somewhere. And you can cause them to focus and converge at some other location besides where you are. It's just like a beam of light that you put a lens in front of and cause it to focus, except you have two lenses in this picture, and that allows you then to cause that focal point to be very far away in our distance scale, light years away,
yeah.
And also you can shift it in time as well as in space. So I have diagrams in the last chapter of my book to explain this idea, but this model gives us a way to explain how it is that psychic phenomena are not limited by space or by time.
But also you sort of described almost the way a hologram is made, as it one beam of light is a direct light source, the other is an indirect light source, and there could be something with the trajectory of time being
right.
A direct and an indirect thing, creating a kind of holographic presence somewhere else in time-space.
Yeah, I call it a four-dimensional hologram, because you have a hologram from the future and also from the past. So it's the distant matter, the patterns of motion of distant matter act like your photographic plate that has the little wavy lines on it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the distant matter of the universe acts like the holographic plate that reflects the energy back to a focal point. But here you have two focal points, one in the past, one in the future, and that allows you to choose where that energy focuses, both in time as well as in space.
So how would you sum up the whole thing, if you can put it all? I mean, you've laid out really some beautiful, I'm sure there's some parts that you didn't get to, but how would you put the whole thing together as a cohesive package?
I would say that the wide variety of anomalous phenomena that we're seeing now, in terms of the out-of-body experiences, the near-death experiences, ESP, psychokinesis, which is affecting things at a distance, remote viewing, all these different effects can be understood if we take a higher dimensional view of the universe in which we are coupled to the distant matter, both in the past and in the future, and it's that coupling, that interaction, which leads us into a sort of a higher dimensional view of what really goes on. And so our physical reality is just a little thin projection of the big picture. And if we go to that bigger picture, things start to fit together and make sense.
I mean, couldn't you just say that consciousness is a non-local phenomena? Wouldn't that also understand that? But, one interesting point in your book, 198, you quote Aaron Schrodinger saying that the distinguishing characteristics of living organisms is their capability of drinking orderliness from a suitable environment. And that may disturb the second law of thermodynamics. And so there's something about life and consciousness itself that...
Right.
That is sort of the key to this coming paradigm, right? I mean,
exactly. The way I would restate the same thing that Schrodinger said is that this is that life force. This is that component of the torsion, which has the negative entropy. And the negative entropy is the same thing as a building of order out of chaos.
Right. I mean, they're calling it negative. I think we need actually, if we're really going to build a new paradigm, we need a new word besides using an old word that refers to something. So negative entropy, I would say life force is.
I like that better too. I agree.
And I would say what entropy is a kind of a negative life force in a way. I think a new science really needs new terms and people understand that now. I think, in the worlds that I interact with, remote viewing, telekinesis, out of body, near death, they're all acknowledged phenomena, and they're not anomalies. They're accepted phenomena that's part of a larger reality. They already exist in my world,
Absolutely.
Right, and this is the world that people like you and also this conference you're speaking at this weekend, I have to say. I mean, I should talk about that a little bit. It's an accepted phenomenon. So, yeah, so I know we're sort of running out of time, but talk about what you'll be saying at the conference. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this conference. It's, it's called Imagination, Spirit, and Immortality, The Quest for Eternal Life. And, it's being held at the House of the Redeemer, 795th Street, New York. I'm not sure if you can give it out the website or not for it, but
yeah, you can give it out. It's drjerryepstein.org.
Yes.
You can go to that website.
drjerryepstein.org, and then /conference08.html has the actual description.
And it starts October 17th at 9:30 in the morning, goes October 17th, 18th, and 19th. And
yep,
some fantastic speakers, including my guest tonight, Claude Swanson. So, yeah, tell us what you'll be talking about there.
Well, what I'm talking about really is what I call my talk is Physics in Higher Dimensions, the Science of the Afterlife. And at this point, as we've alluded to here, I mean, there's a whole lot of more besides what we talked about here in terms of paranormal phenomena and higher dimensions. We have people who have been successful at communicating with those who have departed in various different ways, including electronic voice phenomena, where you have actual electronic devices, tape recorders, things like that. So we've learned a lot from a lot of different sources about what these other dimensions look like, what goes on in the afterlife. And so I'll be talking about that as well as connecting it with the physics models to help understand how, there are no contradictions here. This is just part of the larger dimensional universe that we're all in. So it helps us, I think, to understand who we really are, as you well appreciate, that we are these higher dimensional wonderful beings, and our life here in the physical is a tiny little slice of the whole picture.
But do you think we are the eternal spirit? Like each person has their own eternal spiritual essence. Would you say that?
I do believe that. Yeah, I think that I'm still learning more about this. There are people who have studied this in some traditions for a long time, and it's probable that in these various stages after death and before the next lifetime, if we have to come back, that we have various levels of memory, various levels of access, so that there's a certain identity that continues on, but then our levels of what we've learned and what we can take with us may vary. So I think there's a whole structure here that some people really have studied this, some cultures, for a long time, but in the West we've been kind of slow to take a look at it. So I'm trying to learn more about this, and I'll be talking about some of the aspects of that.
Mm-hmm. I think people like Eckhart Tolle are a great gift to the West, because they say when you reach this place of spirit, it's like as if you are, in a sense, beyond all these things of physics, time and space, and you are the essence, timelessness. You know that. I think that's the ultimate goal, if you want to say goal.
I totally agree. Like Daniel Brinkley, who's been dead three times in this lifetime, and he has what went on, and he sort of says, we're not human beings trying to have a spiritual experience. We're these immense, courageous, powerful spiritual beings that are trying to have a physical experience. So I think that puts the emphasis on the right direction.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Thank you, Claude. Let's do it again sometime, okay?
My pleasure. Thank you.
Because there's a lot more I know we haven't really covered, and I've been talking to Claude Swanson. Is that how you say your last name, Swanson?
Swanson, S-W-A-N-S-O-N. I have a website, Synchronized Universe. SynchronizedUniverse.com, or put my name, Claude Swanson, into Google, and it'll pop up.
SynchronizedUniverse.com. I'm talking to Claude Swanson, the author of The Synchronized Universe, A New Science of the Paranormal, which is really the new science of life, I would say, right? And so, thanks, Claude. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. And if you want to contact me at newrealities@earthlink.net or check my website, newrealities.com. Thank you for listening.